Hey friends, welcome to the Drivecast, a daily podcast designed to help us read it in, pray it up, and live it out. My name's Dan, and I serve as the teaching pastor for our Worthington campus. Today, we are continuing through our series called Love Songs, and we're going to be focusing in on the messages that each one of us did over the last weekend. Now, I'll say this as a caveat from the beginning. The Song of Songs, or you might know it as Song of Solomon, is poetry. Obviously, we talked a lot about that in week one. And because it's poetry, that means that there's going to be a lot of legitimate angles to take in understanding what this poem is. Some of us look at it and see this primarily about a literal husband and wife. Other folks look at it and say, actually, this is far more allegorical. Like it's a story, but it's hiding a more real story behind it. And that's what it's actually aiming at. And just full disclosure, that's kind of the bent that I take in looking at Song of Songs. So I encourage you to listen to what some of the other pastors have been talking about as they see and seek to communicate what God was speaking to them over the last couple of weeks about this passage and what it might mean for us today. All right, I want to look at chapter 2 for a second, verses 8 and 9. I think this is a pivotal section in the book, and not just in the overall storyline of Song of Songs. I think that this is a pivotal section. The imagery used here has become, in many ways, has come to dominate the way the modern church talks about all kinds of relationships, dating, engaged, marriage, and kind of latch on to one of these images. And I think what I was trying to do over this week is ask, like, what might be the shadow side of this image that is there, but what's some of the baggage that comes along with it, and how might we mitigate that in our own relationships today? So let me read the passage, and then we'll get started. It says this. This is the woman speaking, and she says, "The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he stands behind the wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice." That is Song of Songs, chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. And one of the things that's happening here is we're looking at the woman who sees the man that she desires, and he is quite literally, he's leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. I mean, he is going after his woman. Like, he is coming to her. Right? And there's some really concrete language that is there. Just say, one of the themes that often shows up for me as a pastor, sitting down with couples and having conversations about things they're celebrating or things they're struggling with, one of the common themes, if not the most common theme, I hear from other couples is that they've somehow arrived in a season in their relationship where things feel stagnant. There's a lot of different reasons for that, right? You may even think of your own relationship right now, maybe it's your own marriage, and you think like, yeah, we're kind of stale. Things have kind of cooled off in ways that you haven't really anticipated, and you can't even really pinpoint exactly when it happened other than that it did happen. And so oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes, I'll hear something about the husband who's just kind of disengaged, who is maybe not, the word is passive. Or you have a wife who will say something like, it just feels like the rhythms we're in right now, we're coworkers, we're roommates, we are not lovers, we are not connected in a meaningful way. We're ships passing in the night to make sure everything is executed on time in the rhythm of our family. Whatever is happening there, I think the core issue that, or the pain point that people are talking about is a passivity. And rightly so, I think the modern church has latched on to not just verses 8 and 9, but the imagery that kind of echoes throughout Song of Songs and beyond of this man who is clearly taking initiative, right? Again, he's leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills, like a gazelle or a young stag, right? And there is this overall push, and you can kind of trace this in the modern church going back over the last four decades. In fact, if you have been spiritually formed over the last four decades, you will have heard this probably several times, some more than others, but something like, men, you need to pursue your wives. You need to get after it. You need to chase. You need to be intentional. You need to be engaged. You need to reject passivity and be active. And listen, I think that is such a good impulse to talk about this, right? To say that in our marriage, we need to be intentional with one another. We need to be intentional with one another. We need to be active. We need to be engaged. And I think that imagery is really powerful, of the way that the man approaches the woman here, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. I mean, he is getting after it. He is doing the hard work of being intentional to show up and be in her life. I think that is a beautiful sentiment. The question I have is around that word pursue, or pursuit. And again, you may have not heard that phrase before, but then again, a lot of us who have. In fact, I think in a lot of ways, this has come to dominate the imagination of the ideal kind of relationship that we can have, especially in marriage, that we are supposed to pursue one another. And I was working on the message this week, fully prepared to explore all of what that means, what it looks like. And so I jot the word pursue or pursuit down on my little sheet of paper. And you ever have that experience where you're just looking at a word, maybe you say it a couple times, and it just, like, something, it just sounds funny or sounds weird. And I was looking at it, and I just thought, like, well, what does that mean? Because I know we're using it here in this positive context to mean intentional, to be intentional with your spouse. But as I use the word pursuit, like in every other context of life, it's not always a good thing. Right? Like, it's kind of an aggressive word. You know, maybe you think about it like the way, you know, a lion pursues its prey, right? Like, police pursue a criminal, right? That kind of thing. There is something kind of aggressive about it. And I started to ask the question, like, why do we latch on to that word? Why that one? And not all of us are going to think of all the implications. I'm kind of a words guy, so I think words they really matter to me. Not everyone thinks about it this way. But why did we latch onto this word? Surely it shows up elsewhere in the Bible, right? Like, there's got to be other examples of pursuing as a good thing. And one of the things that I found as I was looking into this is that actually we don't really find any positive examples of anybody pursuing somebody else and it meaning a good thing, usually in the New Testament, when that word, the Greek word for pursuit is used, talking about another person, the word means persecute, means to harass. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for pursuit tends to mean to, like, put to the sword or to conquer, to chase after. There's this aggressive side of it. And yet, my question is, like, how do we maintain this posture of intentionality with one another without drifting into something that is maybe over time more problematic? You think about it this way. If our whole framework for dating and romance is, you know, to chase down the one you want, to pursue them, what happens when they say no? What happens when they try and set a boundary? Well, if it's a pursuit, it may not always mean this for people, but sometimes it just means you need to try harder. It so easily can turn relationships into a game of hunter and prey, anyone will tell you, being hunted does not feel like love. It feels exhausting. It feels devaluing. It feels like dehumanizing. And over time, the person being pursued will stop feeling like an equal partner and start to feel like a prize to be won, a problem to be solved, a project to be conquered. And I'm not sure that that's like the healthy foundation for the relationship that we actually desire. When pursuit is the model, that like there is a razor thin line, and we don't always cross it, but there's a razor thin line between intentionality and entitlement. I mean, think about one of the other super common challenges that couples get into over time. Just think about the logic of a hunt, for example, right? Like if I do the work, I track the prize, I catch the prize, then I own it. Right? It is owed to me. In marriage, specifically in the realm of sex and physical intimacy, the mindset is absolutely poisonous. Right? Like if we view romance as like a hunt that we need to chase down, it quickly becomes transactional. It turns into something like this. And maybe you have found yourself thinking this: I pursued you all week. I bought the flowers, helped around the house, played the part. So now, like, I'm entitled to a prize. I am owed something. Right? And again, we don't always cross that line, right? But it is a razor thin line sometimes between intentionality and entitlement. So all of this got me thinking, like, might there be a different word, like a different image that we can think of in relationships, one that can speak to all of the intentionality that we see specifically in Song of Songs 8 and 9 and beyond? And I think that word might be invitation. Let me explain what I mean for a moment. Like, I know that probably sounds a bit strange. Hang with me. All right, think about what an actual invitation is. One of our kids recently had a birthday party, and a few friends from school came over. And as a parent, like, there's actually a lot of work that goes into planning a birthday party, right? My wife and I are sitting down to think through all of the mechanics of this, we had to think through what would be a meaningful party for our daughter. We had to think through the timing of everything, what we were gonna do with her brothers to kind of keep them away, how we were gonna get the house ready, plan the food, prepare the activities. And all of this was to curate an environment where these kids would feel welcomed and celebrated, right? Like, we're trying to actively create a space for joy and connection. That's what we're doing. And all of that work, all of that preparation is happening in the background before any invitation actually goes out. My point is that by the time a person receives any kind of invitation at all, a ton of intentionality has already taken place. Because see, an invitation isn't passive. It's heavy on hospitality. An invitation says, I have prepared a space for you. I've set the table, cleared my schedule. I've done the work to make room for you in my life in this moment because I want you there. You see, invitation actually, in its broadest sense, captures all of what we like about the pursuit language, the intentionality, the hospitality, the desire. All of that is there. And yet it has one other aspect that I think is vital in relationships, specifically in marriage. You see, an invitation in the healthiest sense leaves room for the other person to say no. Leaves room for the other person to sit, like, legitimate room. And listen, nobody likes to be, nobody likes their invitation rejected. That is legitimately painful, especially when the invitation comes from a place of like, I actually want to be around you. I want to be with you. And this is more than just a semantic game here. Like, an invitation, leaving space for someone to say no, gives them agency. It gives them something to be able to say, no, not now, maybe later. And that is incredibly powerful. But on the other hand, right, an invitation in its healthiest form allows us to extend that invitation with the risk of being told no. It allows us to extend that from a place of being satisfied already, not satisfied because of that person's yes. In other words, I don't need them to say yes in order to find my fulfillment. And that is powerful. That is a powerful idea. Right? When you invite someone, in the healthiest way, we're operating out of a place of overflow. We're saying, the table is set. I'd absolutely love for you to sit with me at this table. But even if you say no, I'm still going to be okay. My world will not end. Right? And this, you know, this is absolutely calling us up, because none of us have that posture in and of ourselves. Like, this is pushing us to find our deepest, most meaningful source of satisfaction, content, and joy and fulfillment, not in somebody else, not in my spouse, not in a fiance, not in a girlfriend, you know, not in a boyfriend, whatever. It's saying, I'm going to find that firmly rooted in Jesus. We spent a lot of time talking about what that looks like in the message on Sunday, but we kind of culminated with three questions that I think are really helpful, because I know this is kind of like pie in the sky. You may be thinking, Dan, get to the point, finish up already. Let me give you three questions to think about your own life. And you can kind of have this operate on a multiple different relational scales within your life. And I want you to ask yourself this. If you're married, dating, engaged, think about it this way. When you plan a date or a moment of connection, are you setting a table or are you setting a trap? Right? When you do the dishes, buy the flowers, plan the evening, is it a genuine invitation out of hospitality or is there a hidden agenda? Only you will know. Here's the second question. Honestly, how do I handle no? Right, this is the ultimate test, whether you are pursuing or inviting. If you initiate physical intimacy or ask for a deeper emotional conversation, or your spouse or the person you're connected to says no or sets a boundary, what happens inside of you? Pay attention to what happens, because it may mean you are looking for them to do something for you that really only Jesus can do. Third question, are you asking them to fix your deficit or share your joy? Right? Single, dating, chasing someone because you're terrified of being alone. If you're married, are you constantly demanding your spouse validate you, make you feel important? This is a heavy, crushing burden to place on another human being. Our spouses, our significant others, will always make terrible saviors, not because they are bad people, but because we're asking them to do something they could never do in the first place. But when we let God be the one to provide our joy and satisfaction, when we let His love fill our deficits and heal our insecurities, we are finally free to turn to the person next to us, not as a hunter looking for prey, but as a host saying, I have found living water, come drink with me. Friends, thanks for tuning into the Drivecast. We'll see you back here tomorrow.